Welcome to this week's episode of the Payers and Players podcast. Before we start today's episode, if you would, jump on Twitter and follow us at Payers Players. We're working hard weekly to bring you content that's valuable. And so if you would, on Twitter, subscribe to us so that you can get access to all of the newest subscriber-only content. Thanks so much. And with that, let's crank up today's episode. Welcome to episode 79 of the Payers and Players podcast. We've got an exciting guest. So, Scott, why don't you introduce today's guest?
Yeah, we have Trent Tucker. Trent is the founder of the Trent Tucker Tennis Academy in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Trent was a former college player at University of Kansas and played professionally before he started the academy. So, Trent, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Trent, maybe you can start off and give us a little bit of your tennis background, you know, how you got started in tennis and what led you to the academy?
Sure. So I was born in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and I was a baseball player, soccer player, you know, other sports until I was about 11. And at 11, I got invited to a little retreat at Shangri-La there in Oklahoma. And the guy that I went with, his son played tennis and was, you know, like a, you know, beginner, but had played tournaments and things. And so I decided to try it, and then I was hooked. So my parents found the nearest tennis club a couple miles away from our home, and I was just like an addict that couldn't get enough. I mean, before school, after school, all the way into the night, weekends. I mean, people would make jokes that, you know, I'd never leave the club. So anyways, I was playing catch up, and at the time, there was a boy that was my age that was the number one tennis player in the United States living in Oklahoma City. His name was Crunch. I know that sounds funny. Crunch Cloberdance. And he was on the cover of Tennis Magazine for winning the 12 and under nationals. And I said, man, it's my dream to catch up to this guy in a couple of years, right? So I was on the hunt, and I played more tennis than anybody maybe ever in that 3 or 4 year span. I made 14 nationals and, you know, 16 nationals, all that stuff, and ended up being that we were high school rivals. I was at a private school in Tulsa, and he was a private school in Oklahoma City, and I ended up beating him 5 times my senior year. So that was kind of like my whole, like, I didn't really understand. I didn't have big pro dreams. I just, Crunch was famous, this kid in Oklahoma City, and I was passionate about getting better. So I set this big target to chase this guy, and we had a great group of kids in Tulsa that were all, you know, college level players that were training together. So anyways, that's how I got started. And then my father was very good friends with the Tulsa University coach, and the Tulsa University coach happened to be great friends and played golf at the Kalamazoo Nationals and 18s with the Kansas University coach, and said, hey, you should check out this Trent Tucker kid. He's not really known, and he's playing on center court against the 5 seed at Kalamazoo tomorrow. So I go out and I'm playing the 5 seed at Kalamazoo in the 18s. The guy had just semifinaled at, I think, Junior Wimbledon a couple weeks before. And I have double match point on this kid at 5-4, 40-15 in the third set. And I vomit all over the court. I'm unable to even stand up, basically. This guy ends up beating me, but I won the hearts of a lot of coaches, and I got a nice scholarship to Kansas. And they were a team that was on the rise. And I was, you know, playing catch up still. I mean, again, starting at almost 12. And so I had a nice college career. I redshirted my sophomore year, got some ATP points, got a pro ranking that year, you know, and just really was hungry to get better. But because of my late start, because my parents never played sports, I think it was my thing. And I just, you know, that's kind of what got me into coaching, is when I was, you know, after college tennis, I went and played overseas, and, you know, recognized after a year or two that it's really difficult and it takes a long time to, you know, get to top 200 or 300 in the world. And I would have been probably 30 years old. And so I decided to come back and get a job doing something, you know, medical sales or something, and teaching a little tennis on the side. And, yeah, that's kind of the nutshell of the journey. And then I'll leave it there, and maybe I can give you how Tucker Tennis evolved and started. But that's kind of my beginning through college.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit about, you know, your your 11 to 18 year old, was it our age where you were playing as a kid at the club?
Yeah, there was a club that was 2 miles from my home called Shadow Mountain Racquet Club. And back then, Shadow Mountain had 98% of the juniors pretty much in the state of Oklahoma. They had a young pro at the time, a guy named Doug Boswell, who's, you know, kind of did all the really high level junior development back in that time. And Tulsa Southern was the name of RH91 now, was Tulsa Southern. And Tulsa Southern was a big club, just didn't really, it was kind of, you know, that part of Tulsa hadn't exploded yet. And just there weren't any high level juniors over there. And that, you know, which really was the opportunity for me, though, when I decided to coach, is I went to that owner, who was actually a young guy at the time, and I said, hey, you know, this club's really been dormant in the junior space forever. Would you give me a chance to, you know, run with it and have total control? And he did. So sadly, Shadow Mountain Racquet Club went out of business, you know, just a few years back, maybe 7-8 years ago. But yeah, so Tulsa was really, all the juniors were at one club, kind of how they are now with our club. So that's how it was back then.
So tell me this, is you go back to your development and you're 11 starting, you get obsessed with the sport. I see a lot of kids do that. You go to this club. Walk us through some of the details there. I mean, there's got to be a lot of parents out there that are like, man, he went from 11 finding the sport to 18 playing at Kalamazoo against the 5 seed. On center court. Tell us more about what happened between 11 and 18 when you're on that court at Kalamazoo.
That's a great question. So my journey was an interesting one. I was taking 2 lessons a week at the time, one all left-handed and one all right-handed, because I am what's called mixed-handed. So I write left-handed and I throw a baseball right-handed. So I have coordination on the left side with no strength. I have no coordination on the right side, lots of strength, kind of a bizarre mix. And so I had this coach at the time, Doug Boswell, and we were trying to figure out, you know, what kind of tennis player I was going to be doing one lesson a week. And we finally settled on, I'm going to serve left and I'm going to play right, because I had a good two-handed backhand because the left hand's strong on that side. And my forehand was kind of bad, right-handed, but was okay. And the left-handed serve had spin that was confusing for 12-year-old kids. So
this is awesome. Yeah, I've never heard that. Scott, have you ever heard that type of a game?
I've never heard of that type of game, but you know who else is mixed-handed is Tommy Paul. He writes left-handed.
Yeah, that's right. There's a lot of people who mistakenly, the parents think the child is ambidextrous, which is not true. That's what they all thought I was. But it's mixed-handed as we know today. But, you know, 30 years ago or 40 years ago, everyone's like, oh, you're ambidextrous. But I was not. You know, in hindsight, Doug Boswell and I have joked that I should have been a lefty and served right-handed. You know, so we did it all wrong. We did it backwards. And I always tell people, I probably would have been on TV if I'd have done it the other way. That's my excuse for not making it on the pro tour. But what ended up happening is that I convinced my parents, you know, gave me every opportunity in the world. I mean, they knew nothing about sports. My dad played the French horn in college. My mom only went to 2 years of college. So, you know, really, they had just zero understanding. All they said is, if you love it, we'll pay for it as much as we can. And so I would get up at 5 o'clock in the morning. Doug Boswell would drive to my house, pick me up. We would be back at the tennis club at 5:30. I would do a 2-hour private lesson with him till 7:30 in the morning. I would shower, then he would drive me to school, drop me off for 8 o'clock check-in. I'd go to school, get out of school, and do cross country after school from 3:30 to 5:30, and then do tennis from 5:30 to 9:30 at night and squeak in a dinner, go home at 10 p.m. when the club closed.
Okay, hold on. Let me interrupt you there. So that we did a podcast with somebody, I don't remember who it was, and he talked about every tennis player has to find their Mr. Miyagi, their person who loves them and wants to invest in them. How did that relationship get to that point?
Yeah, so what happened with Doug is that he was pretty young and new at the club, and I was completely, almost annoying. I would just hound him. You have a time. You hit me at 9 o'clock at night. Will you tell your, you know, I just drove this guy nuts. And I would call all the best tennis kids that were much older than me, and none of them would play with me. I recall a famous player in Tulsa, and he would end up winning NCAAs in college in doubles. And I called him one time. His name was Jock Simmons. He's a famous, you know, guy won NCAAs, played in the U.S. Open. I called Jock Simmons one time, a couple years older, and I said, Jock, would you play with me? And he said, no, I got to wash my hair. I called this other kid that was really good. Will you play with me? No, I got to brush my teeth. I called it. So what ended up happening is I developed this reputation as being really desperate and annoying in the club. I would buy everyone lunch, sodas, tennis balls, pay for their racket stringing. I would do anything I could to get anybody in the club to play. And Doug, I think, saw this and said, wow, you never have a kid. So Doug put me in, you're going to love this. Doug put me in a league that was 3.5 men's 70s doubles when I was 11. So I was playing with 70-year-old men doubles. I was playing with 60-year-old women 4-0s. I was playing with every junior drill group he had, from beginners to the good ones. I just went to all of them. And I did every single thing that was available at the club. Adults, ball machine, hitting on the wall. I mean, it was crazy, right? And Doug just said, okay, you don't see this too often. I'll help this kid. And so he kind of went all in with me. And he gave me a lot more of his time. And he was young. He'd just gotten married, no kids yet. So he had a lot of time to invest in a kid that was over the top passionate, which was me. And so I just, and I had goals. I mean, there was a lot of good players in Oklahoma at the time. And I was just hunting these guys, and I was a pusher, kind of a moon baller, because I had a bad birthday. So when I turned 14, I had to play 16s, or when I turned 12, I had to play 4, whereas everybody else got to play that full year. I had the bad birthday by 3 weeks. So I was smaller and kind of weaker. So I had to scrap and claw and slice and moonball. And the kids didn't want to play with me very much. So I just asked everybody in the world to play with me that would give me any chance, right? And that was kind of why Doug, I think, gravitated towards me, as I was so wildly, wacky, obsessed.
That's a real good lesson for a lot of kids and parents out there, because they often want the coach to give that time and effort. But what got that time and effort from the coach was your excited about the sport and dedication to the sport really drew the coach to you instead of the other way around.
Exactly. It got to the point where I just said, Doug, I'll pay to be a partner in every lesson that you give, and I'll just be the hitting partner. I won't say a word. I'll just sit in the corner and hit balls, so you don't have to run anymore, because it's tiring being a coach all day, right? So I'd say, just stick me in the corner, and I would leave school. I would I tell my mom, hey, tell them it's an orthodontist appointment, whatever I got to do, just get me back on the court, right? And, I did everything I could to increase my volume, and I would just run for every ball because I wanted to be there. I was just desperate to scrap and claw and fight and hunt these guys down, So, yeah, I mean, it's a funny thing. I taught tennis for 25 years, and I probably would say I've seen 10, maybe 15 kids in that 25 years that I would consider are legitimately obsessed at that level that I was, now that I reflect back on it, which at the time to me didn't seem strange, but having been in that business for 25 years, it seems like it's pretty rare.
So when you say your game, you were slicing, you were pushing.
Yep.
How did you make that next transition? Did you hit puberty and grow? What yes. caused you to get into a game style that will win in the 16s and 18s? Because if you're playing Kalamazoo against the 5 seed with 2 match points, you weren't pushing and moonballing at that point.
No, it basically, part of the way I played was kind of, I think, what helped me become a good coach. And the whole theory was, some kids just win, right? They just find a way to win. And I was, from the beginning, I was a scrapper and I won matches. I would just find a solution, find your weakness, run down balls. And ultimately, if you know how to win when you're young, you pretty much know how to win for the rest of your life. And a lot of people, I think, mess that up in the developmental process. And I was a guy that was a problem solver, and I made people play bad tennis. Even though I didn't have all the weapons maybe in the world, I was very crafty, thoughtful. I had a bad diagnosis of ADHD, and so the person that diagnosed me when I was young, maybe 14 or 15, said that I had hyper concentration if I was moving, but if I was sitting still in a school desk, I was unable to focus. And I really was able to use mental toughness, the ability to focus for 3-4 hours, and I was a cross country runner. So I would extend matches. I relished in the heat. I loved the wind. I loved when it was gritty and ugly, and you know, just, and I would just make these matches last, you know, 4 hours till guys would cramp and go on, you know, and they'd have to go in the hospital, and I'd just sit there smiling because so I used a different tool set maybe than traditional in modern day tennis, which is big serve, big forehand. You know, I used a lot of different tools. And then when I went through puberty and I went from 5'3 to 5'11, got a little stronger, I was still fast. I had a foundation of problem solving, some tools that were unique, you know, slice, drop shot, roll angle, sneak attacks, you know, different things. I saw the game through a different lens. And then I played guys that didn't see that very much, you know, at the next level. Like in Kalamazoo, for example, I won 5 or 6 matches that year, and it was a 128 draw, you know, so I was in the top 20, you know, so, you know, I had a, you know, and it worked well for me in college. It really ran into the roadblock was professional tennis, because you have to have legitimate firepower, which I didn't quite have enough. But, you know, I think from a junior standpoint and being a coach for all those years, my experiences helped me look at kids and say, man, how do I maximize this kid's limitations or their current skill set? And I tried to, you know, build a culture around, you know, getting kids to find ways to win matches. Because if you win, you love it. And if you love it, you're going to play more and play harder. So that was my whole thing. I mean, from the beginning all the way till now.
Yeah, I coached football and golf for a lot of years. And I used to always say, you know, people would say, what if a kid burns out? And I would say, kids always gravitate towards what they're good at. They'll only burn out if they quit having success. And that's not always true, but to your point, teach them to win and then they won't quit. And the longer they're in it, the better they'll get, right? I love that. I love that mentality. Scott, what have you got?
Well, yeah, I was just kind of piggyback off that. But yeah, you know, one of the things that we hear sometimes is about, oh, that kid, he doesn't win the right way. But, you know, maybe there isn't a right way to win. Winning is just winning. And, you know, if you, like you say, you know, the kids that learn how to win at a young age, they keep finding ways to win as they go through the progression from 12s to 14s to 16s.
Well, let's take that. And if you always are familiar with a player that was in our program named Zeke Clark, and Zeke Clark was, you know, in the 12 and unders, you know, he was okay. He was, I mean, tiny. He ended up as an adult, maybe 5'4". But as a little
kid, he'll tell you 5'8", but yeah.
Yeah, no, 5'5", maybe 5'6". So I give him 5'6" in large shoes. So, but you know, what ended up happening is that the USTA came and it was in, you know, looking at my program, and they were identifying players that had national potential, and he was on that list, but they picked 3 other kids in my program that they thought had bigger national potential than Zeke. And what ended up happening, is that Zeke had kind of bad serve, bad forehand, but he was a winner, right? And everyone said, well, Zeke will be great in the 12s, maybe the 14s. Well, the guy was number 2 in the nation in the 18s. You know, he was an All-American. You know, he's 200 in the world in doubles right now. He's 5'4", 5'5". Point being is that, you know, yes, you do need a certain amount of tools, but if you have a winning mentality and the art of winning is something that's very difficult to teach, as I've tried it. I've had kids with phenomenal talent, natural strokes, easy power, perfect technique, whatever you may. And if they don't understand the art of winning, problem solving, it doesn't, you just can't, you can't download that like the Matrix. It doesn't work. So, you know, I feel like at a young age, you know, teaching kids to recognize different ways to play the game, different, you know, and as you see the Europeans, because they grow up on red clay or because maybe they play soccer, I believe soccer is a really good tennis teaching tool, because you have to be very patient. You have to look for openings. You have to move the ball around. You have to pass it. It's this whole cultural thing that Europeans, I feel like, have an advantage oftentimes in point construction in tennis because of the other sports they play oftentimes. But that's another conversation maybe, but you know, I just believe heavily in, you know, in that philosophy of the art of winning from a young age. I think it's hard to plug that back in at age 20.
Yeah. So transitioning from your career as a player to your career as a developer, you know, you talked about you got to doing medical sales after playing on the tour or playing pro.
Yeah.
What, and eventually you walked from there into a, you know, you said you went to the owner of RH, which was something different at that time. Hey, I'd like to start something at your academy. Walk us through the start, the infancy of the academy, and why you even wanted to do that.
Sure. So I was in Spain. I was living in a city called Alicante after college for a couple of years, playing all the satellite futures pro tournaments, right? And I was training at an academy there that was very well known in Spain, one of the top three or four, and with some guys that were all, you know, 100 in the world, and having this really great training experience, very different style of fitness, of feeding drills, of, you know, playing game. Everything was, it was different than I had experienced growing up and in college. And I thought, man, this model should be brought, you know, into the middle of the country, because maybe there's some of this in South Florida, maybe some in Southern California, who know, you know, I don't know specifically, but this should be, you know, we should bring this back. So when I decided to come home, you know, I had it burning in my brain, and I was teaching at a local park just to supplement some income at the time. And the park was right by RH91, or what back then was Tulsa Southern. And I went to the owner, who was a friend, and I said, look, you know, you've got maybe a dozen kids total in the junior program. The staff is not maybe at the caliber that you know, you envision or want it to be. And the club's not profitable at this point. Give me a shot. And so I kind of wrote down some rough plan, you know, for, I was in my 20s, you know, didn't really know too much, but I was passionate about bringing this European Spanish training model. And that's really, he gave me this shot to teach tennis. I quit the medical sales job. I kind of got this thing launched, and Tucker Tennis in 2001, after I came back from Spain, kind of spawned with a few people that were teaching alongside me. I hired a few people. We kept one, maybe two of the pros. We had about 12 to 15 kids in the program in total. And within a year, we were head to head with Shadow Mountain, my old club. And it was like a war, you know. We were just bringing, we were charging, you know, at the time, this is kind of crazy, Shadow Mountain was charging $6 an hour for drills. Okay. So they had, the market was cornered, and no one could compete, right? I mean, you can't start a bit, but they had like 12 kids on a court. So I said, we're going to do four or five kids on a court and charge $10 an hour, you know? So that's how we started the thing. And then I brought in all these Spanish drills, different, you know, philosophy of footwork and match play and hiring coaches and things. And it really just started to go. I mean, within 4 or 5 years, we had like over 100 kids, and, you know, and then we can go maybe to the next chapter, but that's how it got off the ground.
Hey, can you talk a little bit specifically about those Spanish drills in terms of, you know, what specifically they were and what emphasis they had?
Yeah, I mean, so in Spain, because it's red clay and it's a culture of tennis that is mostly forehand dominated, but it's really about point construction and the ability to go from defense to offense. And I loved it. And I love the idea of moving the ball around, wrong footing your opponent, using heavy spin to open the court up, you know, sneaking into the net, knocking the volley off if the opponent's out, you know, pulled off the court, using drop shots to pull them forward, this kind of push pull and this right left, you know, this philosophy, whereas, you know, American tennis was just basically hit cross court, you know, hit a bunch of serves as hard as you can. It was so one dimensional. And I love the 3-4D aspect of the Spanish style. And then the drills, you know, were a lot of movement based drills. You know, how do you move more efficiently? How do you take away court space? You know, it's kind of this terrain warfare that the Spanish teach really well. And I wanted to bring this idea of how do you take balls on the rise at the right time? How do you lift balls up at the right time? How do you open the court up? What are your 1, 2, 3, 4 ball combos? You know, and really kind of developing, you know, and using that, even though we're playing on hard courts, but we're playing in Oklahoma, it's 110 degrees, it's humid, you know, the ball gets heavy. So we had a lot of, this Spanish philosophy of building and developing weapons in a different way and different tools, you know. So I think the people were hungry for that. I think American tennis all across the country was very stale at the time. And we were in the middle of the country and people were winning. You know, young kids started winning. We're winning Missouri Valley championships left and right. We start, moving up the national thing. And then I hire Matias and a couple other coaches. And before you know it, I mean, the philosophy was really got more refined, each year. And then we've got something special going. So
tell us about that next stage of the academy. You got 100 kids there. You are starting your drills. But how did it go from really from good to great? How did it go from that to something where you had kids going all over the country and it's getting national recognition? And when I walk in now and I look to the left, there's a case full of gold, silver, and bronze balls. And then I walk down the hallway and there's plaques of college kids playing college tennis and so many plaques that like y'all are having to find other hallways to put these things up. How did you go from the 100 kids on court to that?
Well, thank you. I mean, I'm super proud of those accomplishments. We've got over 300 kids playing college tennis and over 60 national balls from about 2004 to 2023. So in 20 years, 60 balls. So really proud of that. But really the biggest thing was I had a few people challenge me that I, were mentors or coworkers. They basically, I had a former coach, a guy named Matt Canole. He was a national championship coach at Baylor. He helped me hire Matias. And Matt Canole once said to me, very direct, he said, "Trent, what's your best ranked player right now?" And I said, "Oh, we got a girl that's 40 in the country right now." And he looks at me and he says, "40 sucks, Trent." And I said, "What are you talking about, Matt?" I said, "This girl's great. We're doing awesome." And he said, "Trent," he goes, you're missing it, man. You don't understand. He goes, "If you guys aren't winning national championships," I said, "Matt, national championships, gold balls." I said, "That's insane. I mean, we're competing at Saddlebrook and Bolitari and all these guys in Southern California that have legacies." He goes, "Trent," he goes, "let me ask you a question." He goes, "Is the DNA of a kid in South Florida any different than the DNA in a kid in Tulsa, Oklahoma?" And I went, "Oh my God, I was thinking too small." So I developed this kind of philosophy in this speech, which was in Tulsa, where we are, there's a little town next door called Jinx, Oklahoma, little tiny town. There's a bridge that goes over the Arkansas River. And I used to give a speech. I'd have a parent meeting maybe once every 3 to 6 months. And I'd say, all the parents say, "You got to think beyond the bridge. We don't want to win a high school's championship. Well, that's great. We don't want to win a Missouri Valley championship. We want to win a national championship. We want kids from Tulsa, because I believe that we can take your kids are not inferior to a kid born in Los Angeles or a kid born in New York or a kid born in Miami. They're just not inferior." And so with that philosophy, I convinced everybody to buy in, coaches, the parents, the kids. And I said, "We are coming after the best kids in the country with our philosophy." The fact that we can train indoors, outdoors, we've got the facilities. We've got cheaper training by probably 60% than Florida or California. We can hire great coaches. They can have a cost of living that makes sense for them and be in Tulsa. So the formula set up perfect for us to create a winning culture, right? I just was thinking too small the first 5 years. And I had to get out of the box and have some people challenge me. And once that happened, and I believed, it was on. We were going after it.
And then what were the next steps? Because like you say, you did that stuff and then go ahead.
The biggest thing was to get kids higher quality hours on court. So we had to kind of bifurcate the program a little bit and not just have, because the program's huge at this point. Now we've got 200 kids and I've got a staff of 16 to 18 coaches. And, it's getting bigger. Reputation's growing in the district and the region. And, so it's like, how do you offer kids that pathway, right? So we start to create modified. I had a small little homeschool program that I was running personally with like 5 or 6 kids, but these 5 or 6 kids were all top 10 in the country. So then people said, "Well, I want to be on that. How do I get in that thing?" So then I hire another coach. I got 3 or 4 more kids. And before you know it, we've got, a dozen kids who are unbelievably passionate about being good and are willing to sacrifice, whatever it is, going to school prom. They want, whatever it is to get on the pathway to travel, to play the tournaments, to do the training. And what was so great was that our club, unlike most clubs in the country, was not focused on profit. And that is a critical component to this whole story, is that I was at a club that basically never told me once, put the dollar ahead of the development. Zero times in my whole career was that an issue. And then I personally was very fortunate that I had done some other investments that I was able to take very low pay and pay my instructors equal or more than I was making. So all of this was kind of contributing to this culture of how do you create a winning tennis formula? Because what happened around the country is everybody's looking at dollars per court, and I'm looking at development per court. So it's a completely different viewpoint that all the other clubs didn't take. And so we were catching up on people incrementally really fast on the big, the big players. And ultimately, once that train gets rolling, nobody can keep up with us because we are solely focused on development. And we're not focused on making, a huge profit, right? If break even or losing didn't matter to us at the time. The club owner was incredibly generous in that respect. And it all just kind of came together in the perfect storm of great coaches being paid well in a city that's easy to live, easy to get around, big facility, and then all these kids that were passionate about training, more hours per day in a very focused, disciplined environment. Where, we could also give me an example. Practice matches are complicated to find. It takes 2 hours, hard to get courts. You got 6 months of winter. We could literally block off all 6 indoor courts and say, we're going to have practice matches go on for 4 or 5 hours today. And no adults get them. No ball machine gets them. No leagues, no nothing. And we get all the courts, right? And I can send 2 kids out there, and maybe one's on a scholarship because his parents can't afford to be here. And no one questions me. And now that kid gets, the ability to develop. And then I said, if you're in the full-time program, you get unlimited free indoor court time. I gave them that to get them to promote play, right? So everything we're doing is about increasing the volume, increasing the quality of the volume, and then, getting people to basically commit on a level that maybe they hadn't ever thought about committing before. And the parents all bought in, and it just exploded.
I would say you created something that every parent wants for their high level child. I heard an analogy one time. They said in business, do you want 100% of your effort, or do you want 1% of 100 people's effort working with you? Think about when you're absent, if you're sick that day, if you're relying only on yourself, that day you got 0%. But if you have 100 people at 1% and 10 of them are sick, you still get 90% done. So there had to become a point where the people you were working with were as much a part of the development of this academy as you were. Do you want to call some of them out and talk about how they affected the academy?
I mean, there's no question that I was not even – it got to the point where I was basically great at giving speeches, and I was great at motivating, and I was great at convincing parents to buy in and all these things, but I had phenomenal on-court coaches. I mean, it started with Matias. When Matt Canole called me and said Matias and his wife Georgie were in Florida and they were having visa trouble at another academy, can you get this done? And we got it done. And Matias, he's a winner. The guy was NCAA champion, was working at a big academy in Argentina with professional players. And he kind of got on court and he, helped me recognize what great lessons look like as far as the focus of a pro. Okay. I mean, he was working with guys that were at the US Open. I mean, he was in the trenches with real, top 50 pros, right? And so he brought this perspective to the whole staff, and all of us would look down the line when we're teaching, five lessons, we're all the way across 5 courts, and you can see a crappy lesson, and we'd call people out, and we could be like, look, man, you're sitting down on the bench on your phone. What the heck, or you're having lunch and a coffee, every single second is precious. So Matias brought this professionalism, this kind of next level expectation, this, and it just permeated through the whole place, right? It made me better. Then we hired Mate Ziga, which is this you know, Hungarian, multiple All-American at Baylor, and a total workhorse, got 70 hours a week, loved to hit balls, was top 10 ITF, you know, great player. We just started hiring people that gravitated towards this culture, right? And so now, you know, I'm standing out there looking around going, God, I've got five or six people out here that are just world-class, right? Giving phenomenal lessons and running the program in a way that is at the highest level you can imagine, right? And so, you know, then we hire Camilo Sabagal from the JTCC group, you know, and then we hire, you know, Celeste, and we just hired all these people. And it's like, they're just top of the top because they want to be where kids want to play, right? I mean, coaches go where kids want to work. And so we had all, you know, Matias and all these people started, you know, building this winning culture with me. And really they ran with it. I became more of a figurehead the last kind of 5 years. They were in the trenches, really putting in the hard work. You know, but it really, you needed me in that position and I needed them in that position because it got big. And to maintain the quality and to keep winning. I mean, think about it. We won 13 balls last year. You know, that doesn't happen unless you've got a lot of people who are doing a lot of good things. It's not one or two coaches. I mean, it's 10. It also takes a great coach who's doing your red balls, you know, who's doing your green ball. If those things fail in about 5 years, you've got a dead gap in your program, right? So we had a really, and we just, and a lot of help from the USTA. They get, you know, the USTA gets a bad rap sometimes. They were phenomenal in assisting us in refining our developmental process. Matias and I worked tirelessly with Jeff Russell, Kent Kinnear, these guys at USTA in basically documenting our process. Like any high level corporate, you know, business would do, we documented, this is how we're gonna start a kid. This is where they go to the next phase. These are the skills they must have at every stage of the process. And then you check those and you know, quantify everything. And it became rigorous and it was time consuming. And Matias and I were exhausted trying to put all this together, but we got it all done. And now the program can really function with a little less, you know, it used to be like if Matias and I maybe weren't doing certain things, it didn't happen. Well, now it does. The program, it functions because the philosophy and the parameters for development are all documented, laid out, and have been repeated now for about 10 years. So.
So now that, you know, so you've stepped away, Matias is moving on to Tennessee. And so just those processes, they're not going to change, right? I mean,
nothing will change at all. And I've been in a consultant for the last 3 years. Matias and I have been intimately engaged in every major issue at the club the last 3 years. I'm continuing to be involved with the club. I'm actually coming back on Friday. I'm going to see everybody, spend a week there. I'm working with the new owners of the club. They are 1,000% committed to actually upgrading everything. They want the program to be bigger, better, stronger. They're willing to pay more money to the coaches. They're doing everything that you could imagine to make it better, right? So I have zero worries. While Matias is a massive hole to fill, I have no doubt that we're going to be just fine and the winning will continue, partly because of the work Matias did. I mean, he was brilliant. And Matias, I mean, he worked for Hewlett Packard, I think, in Switzerland for a couple of years after college. I mean, he's a business guy and he's an organizational guy. He's good with computers. I mean, he's not just a ball feeder, you know, who knows how to play tennis. I mean, and so he helped create, I mean, whether it was our staff meetings, all of the documentation, it's all there and it's been followed now for, God, I mean, years. So I'm not worried one bit. I mean, everybody is such a world-class coach on the team. We're promoting three people because I think the burden of one person, whether it's me or it was Matias, of running the whole ship was too much. So we're going to promote, you know, Celeste, Jan, and Camilo to each run a division so they can really focus and give a lot of attention to each, whether it's homeschool, after school, or the under 12 program. And that way I feel like we're going to be even, you know, more effective because we're not laying all that burden on one person's shoulder. So I'm super optimistic about where we're going and I'm going to continue to stay involved.
Well, I say all the time, the best leaders create a system where when they leave, it just continues to get better. It doesn't fall apart. Right. And I think you, Matias, both have created something like that. And the new owners have two children that play tennis. I mean, my son's there, and he got to play tennis with them the last couple of weeks.
Yeah.
And I don't know this because no one's talked to me about it, but it almost appears to me like they know that Tucker's the best around. So why not go, you know, you can either try to compete with the best or you can acquire the best.
Well,
I feel like that's what they did.
That's the owner. This is directly from him, his mouth, you know, basically said they were having trouble building a high performance program in the clubs they had. So they just buy one.
It makes total sense.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that Genesis, they just acquired a club here in Louisville, Kentucky. So we're hoping that.
So I'm just going to give you a little snippet that I will be in Louisville helping set that up at some point, I think. So just
awesome. You know, just I told my wife, I said, if I'm the owner of this place of Genesis, I'm taking these folks at Tucker that know what they're doing, and I'm getting them to train everybody else and set this up everywhere else.
It's coming. You'll see. These guys have deep, deep pockets financially, and they're passionate about junior development. There's no doubt that we can replicate a winning formula at some of the other locations.
That's awesome to hear.
Yeah. One thing I want to lean into, you said coaches go where the kids want to work.
That's right.
A lot of parents, I think, want the coach to give 110%. They're not necessarily looking at their child and asking, is my child giving 110%? And what you described is kind of, if we build it, they will come. The field of dreams mentality, right? If we build something great, the kids that want to be part of something great and the coaches will come here. But lean into that more. Explain to parents out there, because our main listener of this podcast are parents with kids that are either starting tennis, getting in the high performance world, and they don't know really how to navigate it. Why does the kids' drive matter so much?
Well, I mean, intrinsic motivation is a very difficult thing to instill or create. And it's kind of, unfortunately, it's not that common anymore. You know, and what I would say is that, you know, it's a very delicate balance because what's happened is the game has gotten expensive. So, you know, mom and dad feel a lot of pressure because dollars are flying out the door and maybe the kid gives us 50 runs for half the balls in a lesson or whatever. Right. I mean, ultimately for me, the parents have to allow the child to take ownership over their process. They have to give the child the freedom to fail, meaning to maybe not go on a certain day that they've paid for, and to allow that kid to light their own fire. And if the fire doesn't go, well, then maybe you adjust the budget and the expectations accordingly, right? But in my mind, the best situation is typically when one parent is pretty focused and driven and the other parent is very kind of, let's say, just, you know, kind of a little softer or a little more kind of not as driven as far as what any results are, right? Matthias and I talked about this at length. We tried to look back and reflect on maybe the 100 best kids over the last 20 years. And it was usually where one parent was pretty involved in the process, but not trying to coach the kid, but they were involved, meaning they made sure they got there on time. They did what we told them to do. If we said, you need to do 4 days a week, they did 4 days a week. You know, there was one parent that would kind of check the boxes that we outlined, right? And then there was one parent who basically was just, hey, I love you. And, you know, whatever you do makes me happy. Right. And you kind of need a little bit of that balance. If you have two driven parents or two parents that are completely unengaged, it's difficult. My personal situation, my parents were unengaged. I'm maybe a rarity in that I just drove the whole thing by myself. Right. Typically, Matthias and I have found if one parent is engaged and pretty organized, it's just a delicate balance. Of the parent being engaged and supportive to the point, you know, maybe where it goes overboard, right? But I'll tell you that is the if you're trying to pour the perfect potion, that is a very, very delicate and difficult thing. In my experience, the line of communication with a mature coach, and I say mature coach because what I've seen, and this is no knock on young coaches, but oftentimes when you have a coach that's maybe 25, 26, 27, 3 years out of college, let's say, they have a different approach. They're looking at a 12-year-old like a college kid sometimes, you know? And if you talk to a coach that's 45, maybe he's got kids, married, whatever he or she may be, you'll find that they have some perspective on things. It doesn't mean they have to be your coach, but they can just give you that perspective, right? And having that line of communication with someone that has perspective like that, I think is important to the whole process. So we would do parent meetings all the time, or send, you know, let's, you know, one-on-one, let's you and I sit down and let's talk about the next 3 months or 6 months, or let's document some things, or how's, you know, what's, is the child waking up and saying, you know, I just don't want to go this morning. Is that happening 4 times a week? You know, where is, and having a communication line and try to problem solve some of the issues along the way, I think solves a lot of the potential burnouts or the parent-child frustrations that can develop, or the parent-coach relationship misunderstandings or expectations that maybe their lack of expectations are not communicated. So that stuff for me is critical. I mean, communication is paramount in making a good tennis player.
Yeah, I always, what you described about the 45-year-old coach versus the 25-year-old coach, the way I described it is, are they fully realized? Have they been through a full cycle of development with kids and they've seen everything there is to see, and nothing that can, nothing you can hit them with they haven't seen before and don't already know the answer to, right?
That's right.
And so you think about, like, with Matias, he's that way. There's nothing you could go to him with that he hadn't already experienced.
Jesse, we have seen the craziest. I mean, I could spend 5 hours telling you about all the crazy stuff we've seen with parents and kids over the last 25 years.
Well, do this for me. Oh, go ahead, Scott.
Well, I was gonna say, what comes to mind when you think of the craziest story? What's something?
I mean, I've had.
Give us one example. That's right.
I've had a father knock on my front door of my home at 10:30 p.m. shaking, so upset about their kid's tennis. One time, I mean, I've had parents come at 5 o'clock in the morning, you know, out to a lesson at 5:30 or 6 in the morning, just screaming, ranting and raving. I had a dad at a drill group run out on the court, you know, charging at kids. I mean, I've seen crazy stuff, you know. I mean, I've seen fist fights. I mean, all of it. I mean, what it really comes down to for me is, you know, I've seen a lot of crazy parents and kids end up doing pretty well, right? I just always ask the question, at what expense? And how healthy will that kid's relationship be with tennis? Why did I coach for all those years? Because tennis was always mine. It was always my love. It was always my thing. And I was never fully satiated with my amount of tennis I got, right? I needed more. And I never got enough. I mean, think about it. I mean, I was so passionate about the sport at age 30 or 35, right? You know, so I think if parents can figure out a way to allow the child to fall in love, give them the space, and then give them the support that they need when they do show some interest, that's the perfect formula.
So tell me one last question, and then we'll let you go. There are pros all across the country that are in the boat you were in when they got a job somewhere, and they have a kind of a fork in the road. Are we going to make this thing great? Or are we just going to go through the motions and go home at the end of the day? Give some of those young coaches that are in facilities all over the country right now some advice. What could they do differently? Because ultimately what you did changed a whole bunch of kids' lives. That's what it did. I mean, if you narrowed it down, you changed families' lives, not just the kid, but the parents too. I mean, here I am now living in Tulsa, Oklahoma. When we came here, I didn't even know where Tulsa was. When Scott said Tulsa, I'm like, what? Where is Tulsa?
Yeah.
But it's a great city. So give some advice to those coaches, because really they're trying to make generational impact on kids and families.
Yeah, that's a great point. You know, a great question too. I mean, you know, what it really comes down to is, unfortunately, there has been a little bit of a, I don't know, misdirection, I think, that the, you know, for the tennis business, it's got two issues right now. One is that it's a stepping stone for a lot of people, for a lot of coaches. And so it's like, oh, I'm going to do this for a couple of years because that's what I was good at in college, but I'm really trying to get into banking or whatever, right? And the other one is, I want to make as much money as I can, as quickly as I can, and buy a house or whatever, right? And so you have to ask yourself, and this has been talked about by a lot of successful entrepreneurs, that if you hone your craft and you master your skill as a coach, more money than you probably imagine you could have made as a coach is going to come to you. It just may not be in years 1 through 4.
So don't worry about the money, in other words.
Don't focus on that, because what ends up happening is that you give crappy lessons till 10 o'clock at night. You're standing there unengaged mentally. You're checking your phone every 5 minutes. You're feeding balls all over the place. It's way better if you can do 4 or 5 private lessons a day that are world-class, do 1 or 2 clinics a day that are incredibly organized with a plan, and everybody's getting something out of it, right? If you can do that, in the end, everybody in the country is going to want to hire you, right? But what happens is that you get into the grind. Let's call it the grind. Every coach talks about this, right? And you know, you just say, I'm a $80 an hour barber, right? And I'm just clicking off lessons, 6 a.m., 7 a.m., 9 a.m., whatever. And you're making your $400 or $500 a day or whatever it is. And the problem with that is that it's unfulfilling. You're not creating a skill set for your life. You're not creating habits that are gonna, whatever, you stay in tennis or not, those are, you know, you're not creating the right habits, right? You're not changing. I always felt like, are kids looking at me and thinking, you know, I want to be like that guy. I want to work like that guy. I want to talk well. I want to look right. I want to be respectful. I want to hustle, you know, all that stuff. I mean, don't you want to leave a footprint, right? So like you said, I mean, I want to think back to the 25 years and think, you know, at least I did it the best that I could, you know, and tried to be an influence, tried to give those kids my maximum intellectual and physical abilities for the time that I had them, right? And if a kid bailed on me, let's say in the middle of the lesson, just, I don't want to do that, you know, after a while, I would maybe meet 2 or 3 of those. I'd meet with mom and dad and just say, look, you know, I don't want to take your $100 an hour. It's not fair to you, right? And so you have to be mature enough and respectful enough as a coach to also have that conversation. You know, so I think, you know, you just have to be a good person in addition to being a good coach, because that will, again, that will bleed into the whole thing and whatever career you end up in, if it's not tennis. So I tried to culture that. I had tons and tons of staff meetings over the years. And Matthias obviously, you know, did a phenomenal job echoing all that. And I feel like our staff pours their heart into the deal. I mean, it's like amazing. If you can just watch, it doesn't take long. It takes, you know, you can watch. I have a buddy that's a tennis coach in Indianapolis, phenomenal coach named Brian Smith. And Brian would come with Rajiv Ram and play the Challenger back in Tulsa back in the day. And Brian one time sat up in the window quietly and watched all my coaches give lessons. And he called me at the end of the day. And that evening, he said, Trent, I've been secretly watching all your coaches give lessons all day. He's like, and I just wanted to tell you, he goes, it all started with you. He's like, I watched how you did the lesson. And then I watched all the other lessons down the line for that 4 or 5 hours that I was there. He's like, and it was this culture of doing it with the player's best interest and not just burning time. And so that's my advice, is think about if someone's watching you and critiquing the quality of lesson you're giving, you know, what are they going to call you up and say that was the real deal? Or man, you tanked that and took the kid, you know, the parent's money and just, you know, fed some balls, right? And don't blame it on the kid. You need to bring the energy, inspire, bring a plan, have a process that you're going to be following up on consistently, because it's fun to hit goals. I don't want to just show up every Wednesday at whatever 3:30 in the afternoon and just see the kid. I want to say, where are we related to the last 2 months? Where are we going the next 2 months? That is fun. That's just like growing a business. It's just with one kid.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So anyways, those are some of my suggestions.
Well, it's good advice. I think if every pro out there would take it, they would, not only would they make more money, but they would also enjoy the job more.
100%.
And a lot of them are taking that advice and doing it, but then a lot of them aren't. And so to your point, man, just love what you do and give everything you can to it. And the results, the money, it'll all take care of itself. Yeah,
for sure. And the other thing is seek advice. I mean, I can't tell you how many people I ask for help. I mean, hey, watch my lesson. What am I doing wrong? How can you help me? I ask every coach on my staff, hey, man, how do you teach the backhand slice? Or help me out with this. I mean, there's so much that we can learn from each other. don't be, so many tennis pros are so egotistical. I don't mean that in a mean way. It's just, they were good at what they did, right? And but man, be open to doing things differently, trying different drills, you know, experimenting with, because every single player is going to respond to maybe a different approach. And don't be a robot out there.
Yeah, totally. I think it's good advice.
I have a funny saying I used to say to all the kids, and they all make fun of me over the years. I'd say, you need to chameleonize yourself.
So become who you need to be. That's on right. This court for this kid.
That's right. You got to chameleonize yourself. And I would say that, and everyone would make fun of me. They'd laugh about it. But I really was serious. I mean, you've got to be flexible in your approach. Plus, kids today, you know, they're distracted in a lot of new ways. And they have, you know, it's, and also you can't come at a kid maybe as firm as you could 25 years ago, right? You have to maybe earn the trust, or, you know, get on their level and speak their language a little bit. You know, don't be afraid to be vulnerable. I mean, you know, I've cried with kids. You know, I've had kids call me when they're suicidal, not their parents, not their therapist. They call me because they trust me. And I've had to talk them off the ledge and then call their parents and a counselor. I mean, but point is, develop that level of trust and that relationship with the player. And in the end, you're going to feel good about yourself and they're going to get a lot out of it.
Totally. Well, Trent, we appreciate it. It sounds like we need to do an episode 2 with you just to hear more about it. But this was fantastic. Scott and I have huge respect for what you built. It's impacting both of our kids' lives. Scott's son's been a bunch of times. Honestly, I didn't know about the academy till Scott told me about it. But what huge respect for what you've done at Tucker Tennis Academy.
Thank you so much. And I appreciate you guys having me on and just bringing, you know, what we're doing to the audience. I think if I could just say one other thing, you know, I stand by this thought that in Tulsa, Oklahoma, you can make national champions from scratch. And it has been done now for 20 years, and it will continue to be done. And I'm so proud of all the people that have helped me build this thing. So I appreciate you guys having me on.